Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. Please visit us online at commonwealthclub.org and on Facebook and Twitter and on our YouTube channel. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club, and I'll be our moderator tonight. I am very pleased to introduce our special guest, Steve Cole. He has been dean since 2013 of the renowned Columbia School of Journalism. He was previously a staff writer for The New Yorker and a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post and its managing editor from 1998 to 2004. Mr. Cole is the author of the new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He is a meticulous journalist who unearths the meaning of a story by intensive reporting. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Ghost Wars and a book that I particularly found illuminating called The Bin Laden's An Arabian Family in the American Century, and several other books as well. We other graduates are proud to call him an alum of Occidental College in Los Angeles. Steve Cole has spent years studying the forces that have impacted U.S. foreign policy. In his new book on Directorate S, he reveals how the war in Afghanistan was doomed because of the United States' failure to understand the motivations and intentions of Pakistan's intelligence agency, Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI. Cole says ISI created a special branch, Directorate S, which covertly armed, trained, and financed the Taliban, frustrating American forces at every turn. Today, we're going to talk with Mr. Cole about how America became so badly ensnared in an elaborate, factional, and seemingly interminable conflict. Please welcome Steve Cole. First question for you, and I may say also, please do send me your question cards. I'll start us off with a few questions, but I'm expecting the audience to provide most of our questions tonight. Your book, Ghost Wars, it was a very exhaustively researched history of the war in Afghanistan. Why Afghanistan again? Why did you come back to this topic after your Pulitzer Prize-winning book?
Well, it's part of my life's work. I was assigned to that part of the world as a correspondent for the Washington Post, spent a lot of time in Pakistan and Afghanistan before September 11th. And when Ghost Wars, after the 9/11 attacks, I wrote Ghost Wars to try to provide a reliable history for Americans, but also for Afghans and Pakistanis about the events that had led up to this, you know, change, this shocking change in world affairs. And Ghost Wars ended up with a wide readership, much wider than I would have ever expected when I was writing it. I used to joke with my friends that it was going to be big in Pakistan, but I didn't think anyone else was going to read it, sort of like being a rock band that's big in Japan. But I met so many of those readers in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in the United States, and when the U.S. escalated its troop commitments to the war, a lot of Americans went out there and dragged that book and other books along with them to read. And so I always felt like there was an opportunity to advance the narrative and the history for a similar purpose, to provide Afghans and Pakistanis and Americans with a reliable history of why we ended up where we are. How did we get from September 11th to the stalemate we're in now? And what were the decision points and the debates that shaped this history? You know, 100,000 Americans probably or more went to Afghanistan in troop rotations or as aid workers or volunteers or diplomats. 2,500 gave their lives. 20,000 came home wounded. Not to mention the tens of thousands of Afghans who have suffered in this war and the tens of thousands of Pakistanis who have also died in, you know, massive terrorism waves in their country. So, you know, people understandably want to know, how did this happen? And that's really what the book tries to address.
How did it happen? A few points.
Well, I think the book is organized into four sections that I think reflect the arc of the history since September 11th. The first one is called Blind into Battle, which covers the period from the eve of the 9/11 attacks, where ghost wars ended, until the fall of the Taliban government in December 2001. This was a lightning swift victory that was a retaliatory strike intended to disrupt al-Qaeda after 9/11, because the intelligence services weren't sure that they knew what was coming next, and they wanted to get al-Qaeda on the run so that they couldn't disrupt their planning cycle. But they really didn't go in with a geopolitical plan or even really a very fully developed military plan. And so it ends with the missed opportunity at Tora Bora, where Osama bin Laden escapes and the Taliban escapes and Mullah Muhammad Omar escapes, and they all go into Pakistan. The second section is called Losing the Peace, and it covers the period from 2002 to 2006. And it describes how the United States and its international allies failed to consolidate the victory that they had won over the Taliban government. And there are a number of factors. The biggest one was that the U.S. went off to fight the war in Iraq before it had finished its work in Afghanistan. But there were other important reasons that that narrative describes. Then the third part is called The Best Intentions, which is when the Taliban revive in 2006 with the help of ISI. The U.S. and NATO do not see this coming. They think they're fighting a peacekeeping war that might be getting a little bit nastier, but in fact, the Taliban are developing into a full-blown insurgency, taking advantage of their sanctuary in Pakistan. And the U.S. comes back to the war now, first at the last phase of the Bush administration and then in the Obama administration, escalates it to a point where there are 150,000 international combat troops on the ground. And the motivation is partly to address the threat that the Taliban and al-Qaeda pose, but also to fulfill political pledges that President Obama made during his campaign to fix the good war. And the book recounts the confusion, the contradictions, the failure to really develop war aims that were aligned with resources and timelines. And then the last section of the book is called The End of Illusion, which starts in 2010 and goes up to something like the present day. And it's essentially the U.S. system and the European allies reckoning with their failures, coming to terms with the illusions that had shaped some of their thinking about the war. There's a disillusionment between the United States and Pakistan. Certainly that relationship collapses. Disillusionment between Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, and the United States, that relationship collapses. And yet the war, you know, continues as a stalemate, as it is today. The maps of control in Afghanistan between areas controlled by the Taliban versus areas controlled by the government really have not shifted a lot in the last decade. And that's the ending. Not a very uplifting or neat ending, but it is where we are.
Should the U.S. have gone into Afghanistan in the aftermath of 9/11? Was that a good decision?
Yeah, I think it was a justifiable decision. We had the whole world with us, and we had a deep uncertainty in our system about where things were coming next. September 11th showed that while we had a general sense that al-Qaeda was a strategic threat and that they had carried out attacks, that they had managed to carry out a very complicated and obviously devastating attack over a long planning cycle without being detected. And the headquarters of that planning was in Afghanistan. And there were still, you know, many al-Qaeda leaders and operatives, Arabs and Chechens and Uzbeks, not Afghans. There were no Afghans on those planes, who were undertaking additional plans, and nobody knew what they were. So as a retaliatory, disruptive strike to kind of break up al-Qaeda before it could act again, sure, it made sense, and the whole world was with us, basically. And it happened faster and more and with fewer U.S. troops than I think anyone would have predicted in the aftermath of the attack.
So then there was victory, so-called, over the Taliban. Should the U.S. have pulled back the way that it did?
Well, I think, counterfactual history, rewriting history around different assumptions, I think is kind of a fool's game because the world doesn't really work that way. But I think I nonetheless have to think about this as the author of a book of this length and so much research. And I think if there was any opportunity to create a path to an outcome better than the one we have now, it was then. It was in that period, 2002 to 2005 or six, because a number of things. Let's set aside the invasion of Iraq. Let's assume that somehow we had the wisdom not to do that. There were Afghans pouring home after the fall of the Taliban to rebuild a country that they still held in memory. Because remember, you know, Afghanistan, there's a kind of cliche that Afghanistan's forever at war and nothing but warring tribes. That's just not right. In the 20th century, Afghanistan was poor but peaceful, at peace with its neighbors, at peace internally. It had a national culture that was pluralistic, multi-ethnic. It had a multi-ethnic army. Why did it fall apart? It fell apart because it was invaded by the Soviet Union, and then a war started, and we got into that war, and then we left, and a civil war started. And so in that moment when the Taliban government fell in 2002, a lot of Afghans came home, not because they wanted to support the United States, but because they wanted to rebuild their country. And the first chapter that describes what happened after the fall of the Taliban is called Small Change. And it describes the experience of these frustrated American diplomats who see what's happening, that the possibility of restoring Afghanistan. They've got no money, no budgets. They're going to these ceremonies, you know, handing out tens of thousands of dollars, pathetic sums of money. The Bush administration in its first term was ideologically opposed to nation building and determined to invade Iraq. And that was the missed opportunity. You know, what happened in the next few years was still remarkable. At Bonn, the international system wrote the framework for a new, or actually a restored 1960s era Afghan constitution. Afghans came back and polished up that constitution, agreed on it, even though it involved a lot of negotiations about language, ethnicity. Then they staged a successful presidential election, which Hamid Karzai was elected. They staged a successful parliamentary election. And one of the things the book points out is that Pakistan, which always worried that Afghanistan would become an ally of India, watched this consolidation in these years and saw Afghanistan becoming, you know, potentially a revived country, perhaps allied with India and supported by the international system. And that may have been one of the significant motivations that that caused them to stand by as the Taliban revived and then even to support that revival.
When you say that the U.S. was, the Bush administration was opposed to nation building, again, what factors went into that attitude and the lack of support for the reformation and rebuilding of Afghanistan in that period?
Well, there was they had campaigned during the 2000 campaign very explicitly saying that they were not going to do Bosnia. They thought Bosnia was a mistake. They thought the U.S. should not use its military to create security for reconstruction. The military was there just to fight wars. It was kind of a position that they had written themselves during the campaign. And after 9/11 and the aftermath of the fall of the Taliban, they didn't really move off that. I think Donald Rumsfeld was particularly convinced of this. You know, President Bush eventually came around and supported massive reconstruction aid to Afghanistan 2007, 2008. But by then, it was late, very late. And two other big failures in this period. One was we didn't build Afghan security forces, and we didn't supply sufficient forces of our own to consolidate a reconstruction plan. And the second was that we treated the Taliban just the way we treated the Ba'ath Party, which was they were all, from foot soldier to leader, war criminals, and they were all candidates for Guantanamo. And this, you know, the history of success in warfare tells you that if you defeat an enemy, the first thing you should do is try to create grounds for reconciliation and rebuilding that are as inclusive as possible. Of course, you don't have to accept the leadership of the enemy. You don't have to accept war criminals. You can hold trials. You can hold people accountable. Look what we did in Germany and Japan. But in Afghanistan, we just treated every foot soldier, every lieutenant, every Taliban sergeant as someone to be bundled up into an orange jumpsuit and sent off to Cuba. And of course, it created the grievances and the ground in southern Afghanistan from which the Taliban drew as they started to come back.
Two of my old friends, Zalmay Khalilzad and Kundi Rice, came up with a plan in 2003 called Accelerating Success, which was partly an effort to try to rebuild Afghanistan. What happened to that plan?
Well, I mean, Zalmay Khalilzad, who is an Afghan-American who had gone into the Bush administration at the National Security Council. He was originally working on Iraq, and then he was sent out by President Bush to Afghanistan in 2003, late 2003, to be the U.S. ambassador there. And he served for 2 years, and he was a very, very active ambassador. And he really ran not just the embassy, but all of U.S. policy toward Afghanistan. And he was interested in trying to consolidate, support the consolidation of the Afghan government under Hamid Karzai. He had dinner with Karzai every night. He would get on the phone with warlords and threaten them if they didn't stand down. He was going to bomb them with U.S. forces. He was recognizable to Afghans as kind of a warlord, basically, in the U.S. embassy, though a warlord in a suit and with a very charming manner. And he had access to all of the resources back in Washington. But the problem with, and he achieved things. I mean, that period of time was one where Karzai consolidated some of his authority, where certain warlords who were controlling regions stood down and were persuaded to come to Kabul. But there was not the budget that would have been necessary to really accelerate success. And fundamentally, what was happening was that President Bush, who really liked Zhao, sent him off to take care of Afghanistan while the rest of the government went to war in Iraq and gradually failed, basically. So that you know, for a country with the resources and the influence in the world that the United States had, that was not adequate for Afghanistan's stability.
So tell us about the ISI Directorate S and what role they played in the lack of effectiveness of U.S. Objectives in Afghanistan.
So, you know, ISI, which is the principal Afghan intelligence service, you know, was well known to the CIA and to the United States because we had collaborated with them during the 1980s in the effort to thwart the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan by providing arms and funds to the Afghan Mujahideen in that period. ISI were our partners. Directorate S was our instrument. The Pakistanis insisted that we run our support through them. They didn't want Americans in tennis shoes running around on their border. And we strengthened ISI along with Saudi Arabia during those years with enormous resources. And ISI grew into a rather corrosive state within the Pakistani state, focused on domestic politics, manipulating domestic elections, but also carrying out Pakistan's covert foreign policy, which primarily involved promoting Islamist militias, such as the ones we had supported against the Soviets, to undermine India's influence in the neighborhood, either in Afghanistan through the Taliban or in Kashmir through like groups. So after September 11th, we forced Pakistan to make a choice. You're with us or you're against us. President Pervez Musharraf aligned himself with the United States despite the reluctance of many of his generals. He basically said to the high command of the Pakistan army, we don't have a choice right now. So it was yes, but in the early years, yes, we'll work with you, but we have some other concerns. Nonetheless, Pakistan did cooperate in the arrests of al-Qaeda leaders on Pakistani soil for a couple of years. And the Bush administration became convinced that Musharraf was a sincere partner and fully committed within the limits of his ability to supporting the U.S. So why did this change? Why did ISI start to tolerate the Taliban's comeback? I think there were a couple of reasons. I've mentioned one. Afghanistan started to succeed, and it was seen by the Pakistani generals as an ally of India, a potential long-term ally of India. And that was, in their view, unacceptable. I think they overestimated Indian influence in Afghanistan, but they're prone to do that. They're prone to see India around every corner. But there was another reason. Around this time, the Bush administration reached a strategic nuclear deal with India, really important pivot in the U.S.-India relationship, in which we basically forgave India for breaking out of the nuclear nonproliferation regime and rewarded them with substantial civilian nuclear aid. And at the same time, we said to Pakistan, you're not getting this deal because you're too unreliable. You smuggle nuclear goods around the world, and we just don't trust you that way. And the Pakistanis said to themselves in the Army High Command, okay, you've made yourself clear. You know, your partnership in the 21st century is going to be with India, and we're going to be second tier. And then at the same time, because of the Iraq War, not only were we not investing in Afghanistan, we were actually withdrawing from our security role in 2005, 2006. We turned security in the South and East over to Canada, Britain, Holland, And our message was, you know, NATO, you guys take care of Afghanistan. It seems to be in pretty good shape. Meanwhile, we've got to go finish this war. The Pakistanis looked at that in their frustration about our alliance with India and said, you know, we might as well start planning for a post-American Afghanistan. It's happening now. And that was when the Taliban really came back in force very rapidly. U.S. Condoleezza Rice sent Australian Special Forces officer out to study the war when it started to go back. She said, what's happening out there? And he came back and he said, ISI is back in action. Hardly anyone wanted to hear that. It was too inconvenient at that time. Iraq was a mess. We had trusted Musharraf. But he said, look, this is not just a bunch of guerrillas that are fighting now. They've got rank. They're wearing uniform. They have insignia. They're doing sniper training. They're clearly being prepared for a significant insurgency. And that matched up with other intelligence in the system. But it took a while for the Bush administration to digest it and accept it. And by the time they did, 2007, 2008, the war was really going downhill fast.
So I found it interesting. The director of Directorate S was a man by the name of Mahmoud Ahmad. And your observation about his attitudes, that his attitude was that the Taliban might be considered fundamentalist, but it didn't seek political upheaval. He believed that it represented a strain of faith from the American perspective, essentially harmless, inward-facing orthodoxy. So it sounds like there was an attitude in Directorate S that the Taliban was really not a threat. So first of all, was that the case? And secondly, do you think there was even more active ideological, religious, philosophical support for the Taliban in Directorate S?
So, yes and yes. It's complicated, obviously, in both ways. But, the Taliban had been an instrument of Pakistani influence in Afghanistan throughout the 90s, from the time they first arose in 1994 until the time they took Kabul in September 96, right up until 9/11. Pakistan was one of only three governments in the world that recognized the Taliban as Afghanistan's legitimate government, along with Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So, of course, on 9/11, even though Musharraf pivoted to ally with the United States, the advice from ISI was don't go to war. Don't let the blood rush to your head. You can work with the Taliban. The Bush administration hesitated for a couple of weeks and basically said, well, if you're telling us that the Taliban will turn bin Laden over to justice, if you're telling us that the Taliban will close all al-Qaeda training camps and expel all of the Arabs and others who were involved in 9/11 from the country, we're listening. And Mahmoud Ahmad flew into Kandahar to meet with Mullah Muhammad Omar at his home in Kandahar. And they have this conversation in which Mahmoud Ahmad says, you know, you really need to take seriously, you're about to lose your country. And Mullah Muhammad Omar says, but I'm a Muslim. I'm a host of a fellow Muslim. I can't turn him over to American justice. And Mahmoud Ahmad tries out these religious arguments. He says, suppose you're at prayer and a snake approaches. Is it permitted to interrupt your prayer to deal with the snake? And Mullah Muhammad Omar says, yes, I think it is, as long as you go back to prayer. And Mahmoud Ahmad says, that's who the Americans are. They're the snake. They're coming your way. If you don't stop now and do what you can, you're going to be gone. And he had this debate, Mullah Omar, with his own senior cabinet, the Shura, and many of them urged him to expel bin Laden because they could see what was coming. They had a stronger sense of the international system than Mullah Muhammad Omar did. And he said, you know, same thing. I'm not going to expel a fellow Muslim to American justice. And if we're going to lose our government, then that is God's will. And it means that we didn't listen carefully enough to what God's will was. We'll have to regroup. We'll have to figure out what we did wrong and come back. And that's the decision. He was the boss, and that was the decision he made.
So there are many questions, specific questions about Afghanistan, including the current U.S. situation there. Don't you think that most generals think we will be in Afghanistan indefinitely? And how could the Bush administration not see through the ISI?
So, yeah, two different questions. I mean, the United States has struggled with war aims, really, from the late Bush administration right through to the present day. And at the one of the struggles around what are we trying to accomplish and where does military action fit in the pursuit of that goal is around the Taliban. Are we really prepared to fight a forever war against the Taliban? This was a subject that was different from the question of are we ready to go to war against al-Qaeda, on which everyone agreed. Because even in 2009, when the Obama administration escalated the war, al-Qaeda was still very active internationally, attempting attacks, carrying out attacks in Europe and in the United States. And they were a relatively small outfit. They weren't in Afghanistan. They were across the border in Pakistan. But the rationale of the war was to go after al-Qaeda. But in the Situation Room, as they debated the strategy, they really split on the subject of the Taliban. There were some, including President Obama, who simply did not want to fight a long war against the Taliban. He thought it was unwinnable militarily on any timeline or at any cost that was acceptable. And even Robert Gates, his defense secretary, a holdover from the Bush administration, more or less agreed. He said, look, the Taliban are part of Afghanistan. We're not going to be able to defeat them militarily on any timeline that makes sense. But the Pentagon wanted that war. And there was one scene in the Situation Room where one side of the room was saying, you know, we've never really said we're going to defeat the Taliban. And the Pentagon said, yes, we have. And they went away. And the next day they came back with a big PowerPoint deck. And they put up on the screen like every quotation from every president and every senator who said, we're going to defeat the Taliban. They said, see, you may not like it, but we've said we're going to do this. So they ended up kind of splitting the difference and saying, well, we'll hand this war off to the Afghans. They'll eventually defeat the Taliban or figure out how to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. But it's been a series of aims that certainly doesn't qualify for the Colin Powell doctrine, like go in big, know how to get out, know where your end state is. It's almost been the opposite of that, where we don't really have an end state that we think is achievable by military means, but we can't seem to stop prioritizing military action.
The common belief is that ISI has been a close ally of the CIA. When did CIA and ISI's close association collapse? If yes, why?
Yeah, it's a great thread of the story, and it was kind of fun to work on. Of course, you know, you try to get as far underneath the surface of things as you can as a journalist, and I know there's lots of things down there in the dark that I couldn't see, but the essence of it was really interesting. The first part was after 9/11, when the CIA went back into partnership with ISI inside Pakistan to chase al-Qaeda, who had fled over the border from Afghanistan and had embedded in Pakistani cities. And during this period, they worked very closely together, not Directorate S, but Directorate C, the counterterrorism division of ISI. They made a lot of big arrests. They arrested Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's, you know, still going to face trial as being the principal organizer of 9/11. They arrested Ramzi bin al-Shib. They arrested a whole bunch of other people in cooperative ventures. Now, the Americans at the CIA, I mean, they knew that ISI had its hands in both sides of this war. They were accepting of that. And one of the reasons they tried to stay close to them was they figured that they were still looking for Osama bin Laden. That was like job number one after he escaped from Tora Bora. And they figured, well, if anybody knows where he is, it's probably somebody in ISI. So the closer we stay to these people, the more relationships we build, the more likely we can recruit a source. We can't afford to let distance develop because these are the people who know where our fugitive is. And so they kind of worked together in cooperation. Some ISI knew that the CIA was out to recruit its officers, so it tried to keep its distance too. I mean, it was a real kind of spy versus spy game for a while. And then it collapsed gradually. First, the suspicion built that ISI was really on the other side of the war. By 2008, 2009, the U.S. side didn't have many illusions about that, although they felt that there was a limit to how much pressure they could put on Pakistan because it was so unstable and it had nuclear weapons. In 2011, the relationship really dissolved, and it started with the arrest of a CIA contractor on the streets of Lahore named Raymond Davis, who'd shot dead a couple of guys. He thought they were trying to rob him, ended up in prison. The U.S. tried to get him out, lied to the Pakistanis about who he was persistently. Part of the reason they wanted to get him out was that at that time they had spotted this house in Abbottabad, Pakistan, and they thought Osama bin Laden might be there. Hardly anyone in the U.S. government knew about this. They certainly didn't want to tell the Pakistanis about it. And then the raid, it killed bin Laden. Serious questions both in Pakistan and the U.S. Surely ISI knew about this. And there's a scene in May after the killing of bin Laden, where President Obama reconvenes his National Security Cabinet and he says, let's just stop trying to change Pakistan, okay? Let's stop talking about how dysfunctional it is. Let's reduce this relationship. And Pakistanis basically had the same meetings. We're done with this. Maybe there's some transactions around airplanes and, you know, some other kind of cooperation, but the illusions are finished.
So did ISI Directorate S settle bin Laden in Abbottabad and protect him?
It's possible, but I could not find dispositive evidence of it. I was really looking for evidence. There are some really good, one or two good journalists who have quoted anonymous sources saying that this was the case, but it's not very descriptive as to what happened or when it happened. And I did not develop even my own anonymous sources who could report in a convincing, detailed way. I see no on-the-record quotation. I see no documents that indicate this in a definitive way. That doesn't mean it wasn't true. The one thing that I did for this book, it was very interesting. You know, they seized all these letters from bin Laden's house, Abbottabad, and then gradually they've been dumping them and translating them. And I went through all of his letters looking for evidence of his relationship with Pakistan. And there are two different threads. One is he has these sons who are in Iran or otherwise in exile and wives, and he wants them to come live with him in his compound. But when he writes to them, he says, watch out for the Pakistanis. Do not talk to any policemen. You know, make sure that you get your identity card from the right person. Do not talk to, you know, anybody associated with the Pakistani state. And he delays people's travel for months because he's worried that they don't have the right contacts to avoid the police. But then there's another episode with one of his wives describing how when they move houses, this is before they get to Abbottabad, they ride in a Jeep and there's a policeman in the vehicle. All right. What's he doing there? If ISI did have a cell that settled him in Abbottabad or knew he was there or gave him some kind of assistance, clearly they would have wanted to tell him, don't call us, we'll call you. Would have been, you know, they don't want to get caught with this thing. So they basically would have, you know, used indirect ways to get him set up in hiding, give him advice about stay off the internet, burn your trash, don't talk to anyone, don't let your children out of the house. And by the way, if you need our help going forward, we don't know who you are. It's probably that level of contact. Maybe the occasional meeting once every 6 months or so. But they would have been very cautious, I think.
So this is a seemingly simple question. Why should Americans care about Afghanistan? I assume aside from the fact that our forces are there, but fundamentally, why should we care?
Well, the reason that three presidents have been persuaded by their advisors to send the U.S. forces to Afghanistan is essentially counterterrorism, international terrorism. And now you might ask, why did we need 150,000 combat troops in 2011 to fight a counterterrorism campaign? But the idea was in that phase to buy time to hand off the counterinsurgency war to the Afghan security forces. Today, we only have 10 or 15,000 troops there. The Trump administration has kind of put a lid on transparency about exactly how many, but that's the range. We're actually fighting two different wars at the moment in Afghanistan. I don't think many Americans have a sense of this. One is a direct combat war against the Islamic State, which has a little pocket in eastern Afghanistan, and where we go at them with aircraft and special forces directly. And then the second is an advise and assist war, where we're helping the Afghan security forces in their war against the Taliban. We function as their air force primarily, and also as their kind of intelligence capability. That war is stalemated in part because of the huge technological advantages that we have over the Taliban. They don't have an air force. They don't have any answer for our air force. So every time they mass or try to take a city, you know, we can send planes in and destroy their position. So we have prevented them from taking significant cities, but they have managed to hold on to large parts of the countryside. Depending on whose estimates you believe, you know, from the Pentagon to the BBC, someplace between a quarter and three quarters of the country is either influenced by or controlled by the Taliban. CIA maps are sort of someplace in between, as I understand it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
You know, is the Islamic State a threat to international security? Yes. Is the version in Afghanistan, that little pocket, the most dangerous one? Not as dangerous as the ones in Syria and Iraq were, probably the one in Libya. But it wasn't very long ago that we were, watching the horror in Paris and so forth. So the counterterrorism mission, I think, is supported even in the region, the China, Russia. You know, they all recognize that some of the militants that we're fighting are dangerous for the stability of the region. The problem has always been this broader vision of how does this end? Does this just go on for 50 or 60 years? Are the American people going to be expected to pay for this for another 40 or 50 years? What's the end state vision? And there, you know, three administrations have, I think, failed us by not developing a plausible end state vision that's aligned with America's capabilities. These wars can last a very long time, especially when the guerrillas have sanctuary like the Taliban do, especially when the guerrillas can self-finance like the Taliban can do with the opium trade. And they only ever end through negotiations. And those negotiations can take a long time, but they have to involve bringing allies to bear on the problem. They have to involve making contact with the enemy, even though it's uncomfortable. I mean, you think about the way Britain ended its struggle with the Irish Republican Army. I mean, there were back-channel contacts for many years before they ripened into the accord. Colombia just finished a peace deal with the FARC. That war lasted 40 years, and, you know, the negotiations were long in coming. Our struggle has been that we have, in theory, an understanding that the military part of our campaign is meant to eventually lead to some kind of negotiated outcome. It may not be a beautiful peace treaty with a bow on it, but reductions in violence, the defection of Taliban into politics, some of this has already happened. But we don't actually resource this part of the war. We don't have a Secretary of State traveling around the region. We don't have even a State Department that's fully staffed. We have commanders, military commanders, who say, yeah, we understand this is not a war we're going to win on the battlefield. Our role is to bring the enemy to the negotiating table. But then the only part of the war that really is resourced is military action. We're dropping more bombs. You know, we're sending a few more troops. You know, the idea that we're going to accomplish with 10 or 15,000 soldiers and an Air Force what 150,000 international combat troops and United States Marines could not accomplish, I just don't see where how to accept that.
Let's talk a bit about end games, solutions, et cetera. It's already happening to some degree, but one question here is, are military advisors the solution to avoiding prolonged installments of the U.S. military, prolonged engagements of the U.S. military?
I mean, this is, at West Point these days, I think the assumption is that, you know, you're not going to go out and fight these big army expeditionary counterinsurgency wars during your career. You're going to be fighting these smaller wars, an advisory role and a training role and an advise and assist role. That's the sort of conventional wisdom these days. You see it not just in Afghanistan, but in, many other parts of the world, Africa and North Africa and even Syria and Iraq. The problem is that, you know, the Afghan security forces, though, now significant in size and with a very significant kind of hardcore special forces component of maybe 20 or 20,000 troops that the Americans think are very capable and who do go out and fight hard and take a lot of casualties. They are still a work in progress, and this is still a very poor and divided and fragmented country. It suffers from illiteracy. It suffers from widespread poverty, despite the improvements in, you know, national health statistics. And increasingly, it suffers from factional politics that are polarized along ethnic lines and represent a kind of slow rolling constitutional crisis in Kabul that has left the president estranged from the prime minister and the president estranged from various powerful governors. And this factionalization in Afghan politics leaks into the security services. It means that the army is kind of a series of interlocking patronage networks for power brokers, not a fully professional fighting force. The rates of attrition, the losses that the Afghan army has been enduring. I mean, when American generals are honest about it, they say this does not look sustainable. And so it's not as easy as just being the advise and assist. That's why we've got 10 to 15,000 there and not just a few hundred, because our direct combat and our air capacity is really required to even hold this stalemate together for an indefinite time.
How does the U.S. get out of Afghanistan without the Taliban killing tens of thousands and subjugating women?
Well, I think, you know, how does the U.S. get out of Afghanistan without the Taliban taking power? That's the right question. And I think the answer starts with a recognition that in the neighborhood, there isn't anybody, probably including Pakistan, although they waver, and maybe these days they're back to their hubristic view of Afghanistan, but hardly anybody in the neighborhood wants the Taliban to come back to power. They know that it would be the beginning of another civil war, that this civil war would probably be even more violent and devastating and destabilizing than the one in the 1990s that ultimately yielded 9/11 and a lot of other neighborhood violence. China is a neighbor of Afghanistan. It has visions of economic influence in Central Asia. It doesn't want Afghanistan to fall apart. Pakistan has a growing economy. It's finally restored domestic security after years of terrible terrorism, at least to a substantial extent. They don't want Afghanistan's violence spilling back into their country again. They've been trying to push that violence into Afghanistan, which is why Afghanistan has had such a rough couple of years. You know, Russia, Central Asia, they don't want instability on their border. Iran doesn't. So, here's a situation of geopolitics where you have a lot of common interests. You know, this is not a proxy war where someone is, Iran would like to see us fail in Afghanistan so we get our military bases out of there because they think those bases are there to strike them. But China isn't particularly anxious about our military presence in Afghanistan. They recognize this is a legitimate counterterrorism interest. And besides, we've got military presence around them in many other places besides this one. So normally, if you were trying to solve the problem, you'd start with the recognition that there's a common interest here. And then you would go to work and you would bring allies to the problem and you would start trying to talk and leverage as much progress as you could make. It's hard work. It's unrewarding. It may not succeed very readily, but that's the only way out without having the country collapse.
I want to come back to the current situation in Afghanistan in a moment, but having the dean of the Columbia School of Journalism sitting here is too great an opportunity to miss to talk a little bit about the media and journalism today. Tell us, what are you teaching these days at the Columbia School of Journalism? What are you teaching young journalists?
We're teaching reporting. We're teaching how to get it right, how to get underneath the surface of things, how to report independently. We have a very heavy reporting-focused curriculum. We tell our students when they come in, which is a form of saying research, interviewing, public records, investigative reporting techniques. Every student is required to take both basic reporting, going out on the street, talking to strangers, going into courthouses, figuring out how to cover a trial, going to a press conference, going to City Hall, finding stories in neighborhoods, walking around New York City and talking to people about what's going on here, walking into housing projects, and then additionally investigative reporting techniques using court records, litigation records, real estate records, tax records, nonprofit filings, big databases, and FOIA requests to develop original insights into matters of public interest. I think what we tell our students at the beginning of, we're just a graduate school, so the students who've come there have chosen this as a profession, so we're not teaching this in an undergraduate context. And we tell them at the beginning, first of all, if you don't like to talk to strangers, you get your money back. secondly, this school was founded by Joseph Pulitzer before the advent of radio. And he had a vision of professional journalism and its role in democratic societies and, a sense of why it was constitutionally protected. That turned out to be correct and foresightful, and that outlasted television, radio, cable television, the World Wide Web, social media, Facebook. And our faculty just has a great sense of confidence that this is what journalism is about, is that role of independent fact gathering and communication to try to inform the citizenry. So it's been a great time for journalism, actually, a challenging time, but also a clarifying time. This is, the president's attacks on the press in many ways have strengthened the press. They've certainly strengthened our school and the sense of clarity of what it is that journalists do. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, when I first came to Columbia, with the digital revolution and the collapse in newspaper business models and the rise of social media and the sense that, we're all journalists, amateur journalism, citizen journalism. There was an understandable sense of confusion among the young people who came to the school about, well, what is journalism exactly? Trump has cleared this up. been very helpful. This year, everyone's kind of sitting up straight, paying attention. Now they have questions. I'm a person of color. How do I go out and report on white supremacists at a rally? Okay, let's talk about that. That's something we can talk about. That's journalism. And anyway, the performance of the strong newsrooms in the country, the Washington Post, New York Times, and others, has really demonstrated a very teachable moment for us at the school, I think.
Your former newspaper, the Washington Post, is now owned by Jeff Bezos. Mm. What difference has that made? What's going on at the Post? Strong journalism, strong newsroom. What's the Post status?
I mean, he's been a fabulous owner. I was pretty skeptical when he came in because he had no track record in the field. But he's invested really well in the technological side of the newsroom, which really needed to change itself and become digital first in a meaningful way. He left in place in Marty Baron, a very able editor, who's done a fantastic job. He has stood by the paper when it came under pressure, whether it was when their correspondent was arrested in Iran and they mounted that campaign to get him free, which succeeded. He just went back to work a couple of weeks ago. And he's not interfered in the newsroom at all. And the morale in the newsroom has gone from, the pits where it was before he bought it to soaring. And you can see the vigor in the file every day. I still have a lot of friends there, and it's a very exciting time, and it's great for the country to have the Post back in action. I think his net worth is something like $90 billion. So I guess it varies. Maybe now it's 60 after the market performance of the last couple of weeks. But either way, I mean, the subsidy that he, has to deliver to the Post, if he delivers a subsidy, they say that it's profitable, but I mean, he's privately held. So, who's going to determine what they're counting. But I mean, this is like, this is like his coins in his sofa, basically, to keep the Post going.
So is he willing to keep doling those coins out?
Evidently, yeah. I think what I hear is that he says, he's in it for at least 20 years. And he has a vision. I think he came in with a vision, at least as I heard it. I've not spoken with him directly. But what I understood was that in something that made sense, which was, why was he motivated to do this? Partly it was he wanted to change the way people read news in a way analogous to the way he changed the way people read books. That he was going to do for news and news business models what he did for the book industry by essentially creating the Kindle and the ebook model. After a lot of struggle over pricing and various other things, we've ended up in a good place with him. Thank you. This vision of people paying for news in a readable format that was derived from his experience with ebook publishing, I thought that was a pretty good place to start. But I think what's actually happened from what I can see from a distance is that he has discovered the thing that you can see in the movie The Post, which is it's really fun to own a newspaper, and there's nothing quite like it. And so I think he's enjoying himself.
Okay. What do you see as the other bright spots in the media in this country?
Well, there's a lot of strong reporting in response to the departures that the Trump administration has undertaken. Let's set aside our ideological polarization in this country and just talk about the way the Constitution and the presidency has operated over the last 20, 30, 40 years. You know, we've seen a series of departures about transparency, about tax returns, about conflicts of interest in business, about a whole series of decisions. And the press, and not to mention the Russia investigation and the pressure that the president has tried to put on that investigation and the role that the press has played in making transparent for Congress and for the public, you know, what's going on here and trying to provide a kind of an outlet for information that would otherwise be suppressed about what's going on. One thing, you know, I'm kind of a creature of Washington. I spent 20 years at the Washington Post and you know, was an editor there for a good run. And this administration, ironically, is the leakiest, I mean, by orders of magnitude, that I have ever seen. And I, when I talk to colleagues, I mean, they're all a little bit stunned, given the hostility of the Trump administration to the working press, about how you can talk to everybody every day about everything. You know, it's like, I mean, the Obama administration was really hard to cover. So closed, so super disciplined, but also always on message and relentlessly, boringly on message. And you know, almost kind of suppressing the truth by being so effectively on message. And I mean, the Trump administration, you know, if you can't handle the truth, watch out, because you're going to get a big dose of it every day. Now, you can say it's a distraction, and it is, and the president is a performer, and he's a disruptor, and you know, he made his instincts were honed on live television in a kind of reality TV setting. So yes, of course, he's controlling too much of what happens every day in Washington. But the pushback, the enterprise reporting, the investigative reporting that's gone on, and the creativity that professional reporters have used to just do basic things, like the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who was flying around on private jets, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, and not providing any access to working journalists that would have allowed them to discover this. What did they went out and stalked Dulles Airport, you know, picked up airplane, you know, whatever you call those call signs on airplanes, and trace these, you know, very painstakingly. Look at the Roy Moore reporting. I mean, I was talking to an editor friend of mine who commissioned that reporting, and that Stephanie McCrumman, who went down there, she went down just on an instinct and just was going to do a different kind of story. And just by being on the ground, by being, you know, funded by the Washington Post to go down there and just ask what's going on in this hometown of his, she met these women who came forward and ultimately changed, you know, the outcome of that race. And, you know, this is what journalists are supposed to do. And there are now, there's now a kind of a sense of engagement between those news outlets and their audiences that include subscriptions that are allowing these newsrooms to fund this kind of work in a way that didn't look so viable, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Is there, aside from Jeff Bezos' couch spare change, is there a viable financial model, business model for newspapers today, other kinds of media? Has the slide in the financial status of newspapers come to an end?
No, not local newspapers. They're still struggling to complete some kind of sustainable transition to a digital model. And the biggest challenge is subscriptions. The digital advertising market is a bit of a mess, and it's captured by Facebook and Google, but it does provide some potential for a mixed revenue model for newspapers. And there are some newspapers that have already had the growth in digital advertising overcome the loss of print advertising. Obviously, everything is at a reduced level. But the big challenge is getting people to pay for news. Now, you know, the New York Times is the only place that has really solved that problem. And they're running, you know, a high demographic national strategy. And they're charging, many of you may pay that freight. I mean, it's not cheap. But they deliver value for that money. And the problem is that the Chicago Tribune, you know, the Indianapolis Star, the Des Moines Register, they have not figured out in their communities how to replace the subscription revenue they're losing from print with digital subscription revenue the way the Times has. Maybe we'll get there. I think there are probably lots of different solutions at the local level that are going to be necessary. We try to work on that at the journalism school. I think of this as kind of like a public health crisis. If I were at a public health school, I'd see this as an epidemic, the loss of locally generated reporting that's sustainable, that's funded locally outside of Washington. New York and Washington will be fine, and California is going to be fine. But, you know, you look at that USA Gymnastics story, that monster who thrived, in that setting for so long. Now, it was the Indianapolis Star that brought that story forward. At that guy's sentencing, you know, the judge said, thank God for the journalists. But that's the kind of story that you can really only do locally with trusted reporters that are in the community, whose kids are in schools there, you know, who are going to church on Sunday, who are recognized as locals and who people trust and who they can, you know, take risks with to get this information out there. And if we lose professional reporting in newsrooms like that one, you know, our civic health is going to decline, I think, in a significant way.
Last broad journalism question. Where do your students go after they graduate? What do they want to do? What's the fire in their belly?
They all want to work for Vice, basically. I mean, we have the biggest job fair in journalism, and it's on a Saturday in the spring, and I usually walk through this cavernous hall at Columbia, and there's all these desks, different news organizations there, and there's like this really long line in front of Vice. I see my students there, the ones in my classes, especially the good ones, and I go up to them and say, get out of this line, would you? Go over there. There's a guy from the newspaper in Milwaukee that's hiring a statehouse reporter in Madison. It's a much better way to get started. But anyway, there is they're being hired across the boards. What's happening is a good time to be a young journalist with a millennial sensibility and digital skills. Legacy news organizations are restructuring around those people at the expense of, you know, people in my generation sometimes. And all these digital-first startups or new generation outfits like Vice and Vox and BuzzFeed are hiring those kinds of young journalists as well. Our students end up everywhere in the field, but what's happened, and you can see this, it's in economic statistics as well, is that we've come out of the shrinkage of journalism jobs. We're basically at the levels of total employment, you know, by some, at least some studies, that we were before the great disruption. But the structure has changed substantially. It's basically all migrated to the two coasts, and it's very heavily located in the kind of digital and venture capital environment that you see. You know, it's not just Vox and Vice, but also the New York Times is unrecognizable in the way that its newsroom is organized compared to, you know, even 10 or 15 years ago.
Back to Afghanistan.
Okay, thank you.
Do you think the Trump administration's proposal to go after terrorists who take refuge in Pakistan will be effective? And if so, why or why not?
Right, so this is the change in the Trump administration's posture when they came in. They did a study about the Afghan war, just as the Obama administration had done, just as the Bush administration had done a number of times. And these, you know, debates that they inherited are chronicled in this book. And the Trump administration had a discussion in which Steve Bannon said, let's pack up and go home, America first. But that, in the end, didn't get much traction, I don't think, in the Situation Room, from what I hear. And really, it was Mattis and McMaster, the Secretary of Defense and National Security Advisor, respectively, who persuaded the president that he had to commit to this cause and that he could do so while being tougher than his predecessors, and that appealed to Trump. So the way he got tough was to call out Pakistan. So we've suspended aid to Pakistan, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think at Mar-a-Lago on New Year's Day at 6 a.m, the president tweeted that Pakistan had given us nothing but lies and deceit and so forth. And why he was thinking about Pakistan on New Year's Day, I don't know, but maybe it was an index card that had been set up for that tweet. But it was a kind of a public shaming and a threat to Pakistan. So that's and then there's also been a kind of reposturing of the U.S. commitment to Afghanistan. The Trump administration says we're going to fight to the last terrorist. We're never leaving. And the purpose of saying that is to try to signal to Pakistan and the Taliban, you can't outweigh us, although they will try anyway. We do. They know we have domestic politics and only 10 or 15,000 troops there. So will it succeed? The record of imposing economic sanctions on Pakistan in order to change its strategic calculus is a sorry one. It has never worked. The withholding of aid to Pakistan, you know, is perfectly understandable. If it were coupled with a negotiating strategy that included China and the region, you know, maybe it would move the ball. But, you know, Pakistan has nested itself since 2011 in its deep, deep relationship with China. And China is its all-weather friend, as they say in Pakistan, whereas we are the you know, unreliable partner. And China's economic aid, China's future in the neighborhood, the fact that Pakistan, that China doesn't even have an ally like Pakistan, other than Pakistan. I mean, this is a very deep relationship. And I think, you know, Pakistan can feel that it has some resilience in this relationship. You know, Pakistan has always liked to have a good relationship with the U.S. and a good relationship with China, but they can live nested in that alliance with China if they need to.
Which prompts the next question. What are the prospects for future Sino-Pakistani relations? Where is the relationship headed? Are the Chinese likely to handle it any better than the U.S. did?
Well, the Chinese are trying to build an economic corridor through Pakistan and to deepen their own kind of economic potential and options and supply lines in Central Asia and to the Arabian Sea. They've been building, you know, infrastructure in Pakistan for many years, but they've really increased their investments in the last few years. They have a vision of the region that is rooted primarily in infrastructure. They kind of free ride on our security operations in Afghanistan, right? So we kind of keep Afghanistan from completely collapsing, and they build roads across the way in Pakistan to support their trade goals. You know, I think in the big picture, we're headed into a 21st century of great power competition of some dimension, assuming we don't get some radical break in direction. That will involve China, the United States, Russia, and India. And China sees India as a potential competitor, still much smaller economically than China, but rising. It sees the United States warily. And I think it sees Pakistan as an essential regional hedge against a U.S., India, Japan, Asia alliance, that this is a relationship it cannot afford to let go of. You know, can we, in a broad sense, reach an accommodation with China's rise in the world that doesn't require one of those great power wars that throws the world into darkness as we've had before? If we can, then finding room for Pakistan and India in this neighborhood is essential. And there's really, you know, Pakistan does not have to follow the path of support for radical Islamist groups and the kind of proxy war with India that has dominated its army-written foreign policy. There's another Pakistan of a middle class and a civil society and a very talented diaspora, a growing economy. It has real potential. If it would not be so badly ruled by the army and ISI, it might even have discovered a detente with India by now. You know, and India's has its own problems with right-wing nationalism at the moment. So it's if there's a bedrock in this equation, it's the relationship between China and Pakistan.
If the U.S. were to decide to get out of Afghanistan, how should we go about it? What would happen in Afghanistan and the countries that have a stake?
Well, I think we addressed that question earlier, and I think the most responsible way out is through a negotiated exit that involves allies and the region and the neighbors. If we just followed, you know, Steve Bannon's reported advice and packed up and went home, said we're leaving in 6 months, good luck. I think it would be very difficult for the Afghan security forces to sustain their grip on the cities that they hold now. And, you know, the Taliban would certainly make progress, at least in the south and maybe parts of the east, and possibly threaten Kabul. You'd have a divided country. You would have also, if we left, you know, Iran and Russia would come in the way, and India to resource their allies in a civil war. That was the scene in the 1990s, and it was an ugly one. This war would be even more intense because the weapons are bigger, and I think it would be a mess. It would be destabilizing and a humanitarian nightmare.
So reading your book reminded me of another journalist I knew long ago and his book, David Halberstam, The Best and the Brightest. In a way, it's a similar story of the progressive U.S. involvement in Vietnam, poor decisions that were made, hubris, lack of cultural understanding. Do you see parallels there between Afghanistan and Vietnam? And is this kind of always the story when the U.S. embarks on fighting anti-insurgency warfare and forces inimical, we see as inimical to our interests in a far-flung area of the world?
Yeah, well, we certainly forget the lessons of our own history. And yes, I mean, when I was a student at Occidental College in the late 70s, I read the Los Angeles Times every day, and then I read those books. I read those Vietnam books by New York Times correspondents who had been out there in the war, came home and wrote the definitive journalistic accounts of how this had happened. The Best and the Brightest was one of them that was on my shelf. Another was Neil Sheehan's Bright Shining Lie, Francis Fitzgerald's Fire in the Lake. I can remember. I mean, these were big books like mine, and there were other ones, in some other areas, not just Vietnam books, but there were sort of six or seven of these narrative nonfiction books of a certain kind that tried to unpack this sort of history and these failures that I had on my shelf from the beginning. And I said, someday I'm going to write a book like that. And that's why I went out to be a foreign correspondent, because I noticed that all those authors had gone out and worked in the field before they turned to the big books. And as to Vietnam, the repetitions are there. I don't know how many of you saw the Ken Burns documentary, but as I watched it last fall, and after working on this for 5-10 years, I thought, oh my gosh! I mean, it's disheartening that these patterns can recur in a democratic system where we're not suppressing information. I mean, this is it's not like this is buried in Stalin's archives. There's a scene where Richard Holbrooke was Obama's special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan in the first couple of years before his death in December 2010. And, of course, he started his career as a diplomat in the Mekong Delta. And he became estranged from Obama right away because he had worked for Clinton and he was a kind of a big personality and he just rubbed the president the wrong way. And that was really an unfortunate way that personal politics interfered with such critical decision making. But, one of the things that annoyed President Obama about Richard Holbrooke was that he would talk about Vietnam in the Oval Office. He would say, Mr. President, watch it. I've seen this movie. And Biden would do the same thing. And Obama would kind of dismiss that. This is not Vietnam. And I was going through my records as I was getting ready to write the chapter around that. And I used to talk to Holbrooke from time to time. And sort of I tried to muster all of these experiences I'd had at the time into the book. And there was this conversation we were having that I'd transcribed in which he said he reported that the president was annoyed at him because he kept talking about Vietnam. And then he said, they shouldn't be so afraid of history. And that sentence kind of jumped out at me.
So I hope you're teaching your reporting techniques also to those students at Columbia. So our thanks to Steve Cole, Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University, staff writer for The New Yorker, author of the new book, Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Thank you to our audience here in San Francisco this evening, our audiences on radio, television, and the Internet. Mr. Cole's book is available here. He'll be pleased to sign books right outside the room immediately following the program. I'm Gloria Duffy. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much.